student who can't make it. Today, what we're going to try to cover are the remaining main issues in the text that you're reading from John Locke. And it goes from his critique of the concept of a capital S substance that I talked about last time, all the way through to problems that emerge because of the loss of our right to use the concept of a capital S substance when thinking about matters that are partly, when trying to sort out how to account for the identity, first of material things, material physical objects, and then how to account for the identity of immaterial things, minds, persons. And last time I tried to walk us through why there's a deep relationship between the traditional conception of a real substance and our ability to give an account of the identity of a material object. And in order to understand how the traditional concept of a substance plays a role in helping to account for the identity over time of a material object, I'm going to tell you a little story that comes from Aristotle. Aristotle was one of those people who first in the West worked out a fairly clear theory of what it is for any material object to exist. For him, any material object consisted of what I've been calling a substance, which is a propertyless substrate. Remember that phrase, propertyless substrate. Substrate without any properties, which for Aristotle was called matter, and a form. And the word form, the concept of form, just refers to the properties that are essential to that thing, without which it wouldn't exist as the sort of thing it is. Okay? So, Aristotle thought that everything that existed, fundamentally, was, as I told you when we were studying Descartes, and I was giving you the background against which mechanistic scientific explanation operated, and how different it was from Aristotelian metaphysics and that way of explaining the existence and nature of physical things. I mentioned this idea that what fundamentally existed for Aristotle were individual entities. There isn't something abstract, universal, and eternal called the form of human, as Plato thought, which each individual concrete human being, in a sense, copies from or is an instance of or participates in. Plato thought that you might say the design of a human being, the set of essential properties that capture what a human being is, pre-exists any concrete human being. And without these abstract eternal forms, paradigms, if you will, individual concrete things of any kind could not exist. So the paradigm has to exist in order for individual instances of the paradigm to exist. Aristotle rejected that view and took the view that what's fundamental are individual concrete things, and those concrete things, the part that Plato identified with the form, Aristotle also thinks is a set of essential properties without which that thing cannot be the sort of thing it is. But he thought that the idea of that form was something that we acquire through contact with concrete things that have that form. And that form, which is detectable through perception and reasoning about perception, cannot exist for Aristotle unless it has something that has no properties but can play the role of the site, the home, the matter, the substrate in which those properties reside. Okay? And the model I used, I'll repeat my metaphor, if you're familiar with Mr. Potato Head, you have a little plastic, like a mustache, glasses, eyes, nose, ears, right? Think of those as properties. And those are being attached to the potato. those little plastic things that you're attaching to the potato are the form of the entity you created with your Mr. Potato Head kit. And the potato is the matter. It doesn't contribute anything except a place where things can reside. I also have used the metaphor of a pin cushion. The pins are the properties, the cushion is the matter. Okay? Properties form. Okay. Now, with that in mind, how do I identify the identity of any individual object? Well, Aristotle tells a story which is meant to illustrate, to evoke your common sense intuitions about how the identity of individual material objects is established. And it's the story of a ship, the ship of Theseus. And the story goes like this. If you were to take an existing ship, that ship, the ship of Theseus, and bring it into dry dock, remove all the boards, move them into a second dry dock, get a new set of boards, exactly like the originals in shape and function, assemble them according to the design of the original ship, and you took the old boards from the original ship in the second dry dock, and you assembled them in a new way according to a different form, a different shape. So you now have two boats, but they have different sailing characteristics, they have a different shape, one is faster than the other, one carries more, perhaps the faster one carries less, the slower one carries more because of the shape of the hold, and so on. Are you clear about the thought experiment? So you have the original ship, you take the boards from the original ship, and you create a new ship on a different design. And the old board, with the old boards, you get new boards and you recreate the original ship using those boards according to the original design. So you now have two ships. Which one is the ship of Theseus? Is the question he asks. And how you answer that question will reveal your preferences regarding two intuitions we have about what makes any material object self-identical over time. So, which of these two ships is the ship of Theseus, do you think? Matt? So you think that what determines the identity of something is its form.
I guess. Yeah.
Okay. And that's one very understandable intuition. Did anybody have the other intuition? That the original ship goes with the boards. So we've got an alternative view. Aristotle's answer is neither of these ships are the ship of Theseus any longer because you need both the same matter and the same form. Okay? Now, I'm only telling you this story so that you'll have a sense of the kinds of problems you're trying to solve when you're trying to figure out what makes something identical with itself over time. Am I the same human being that I was when I was five? Not according to that, yes. Because I'm a living thing. Actually, Aristotle thinks that I am self-identical with what I was at five. But that's because what makes my form includes a bunch of functional properties and don't depend as much on a particular substance. So hold up. The identity of this chair, however, and the ship of Theseus as one of these kinds of material objects, is determined both by its matter and its form, and if it loses any significant proportion of either, it ceases to be the same ship. So this will be the same chair until it gradually erodes to the point where, right, it breaks down. But as long as it retains the same shape, and long as it retains the same matter, the same stuff out of which into which it takes that shape, the shape that it takes, just like the statue of, what's a famous statue? Lincoln. Lincoln and the Lincoln Memorial, right? As long as that has the shape and the same material as its as it had originally, it'll be the same statue. Now, living things are somewhat different. And Aristotle's account of that involves not making so much out of the particulars, the sameness of the matter, the same cells, but rather their mode of organization and their way of functioning. So I don't have to retain all the same cells in order to be the same human being, because I'm a functional entity, and what is essential to me is not the particular matter I take, but that the functions of that matter remain the same over time. My heart, which has been gradually giving up cells and, you know, and replacing them with new ones every 7 years or so since I was born, has been pumping continuously and feeding all the other parts of this body, which, if you had a space-time chart locating my matter over time in all of its locations, you would see that that heart was the same heart pumping blood to the same body. And that's all it takes for me to establish my identity over time as a human being, because the functions of all of my parts, while at the cellular level have changed, you know, at the cellular level the matter has changed, but the functions of that matter have remained the same. So this is a modified view, and this is the way that Locke accounts for the identity of material objects. He needs this theory because he can't appeal to the idea of a propertyless substrate in the way that Aristotle did. Okay? And in order to solve the problem of how to account for the identity of even these chairs, since he doesn't have access to the unique making matter, which is part of what the matter is doing, the matter is actually playing the role of infusing in any material object something that is unique to it. All these chairs have the same form, but they have different matter. And without the different matter, which doesn't add any properties to the chair that are relevant to its essence for Aristotle, but the matter is essential to making this chair different from this chair, different from this chair for Aristotle. And traditional rationalist metaphysics took the same view. And that's what Locke is attacking. So what he has to do is to find out something that preserves uniqueness, which is a present to perception, and a propertyless substrate is not present to perception. Because remember what I said last time. We can't have any ideas of anything that pertains to this domain of our perceptions unless we can trace that idea's origins back to original simple ideas of sensation. But the idea of a propertyless substrate is an idea which points to something that has no properties. But every idea of a sensation is the idea of a property, a mode. And for that reason, I don't have any perceptual access to original sensations that could stand for and be the source of my idea of a substrate which contributes nothing by way of properties. It only contributes, it's the place that, it's sort of the thing that holds all of the properties together in one entity. But that itself is not a property, it looks like, given the way Locke speaks about this. So what I'm doing here is trying to combine a critique of the concept of a substance, a propertyless substrate, which he says is a something I know not what. We cannot know anything about it because the idea refers to something which we never perceive. And his own theory of ideas is the source of the evidence. The lack of any simple ideas of sensation in principle for anything that has no properties causes him to decide that the concept of a capital S substance is something he cannot have any knowledge of, is in effect it's an empty idea. But of course it worries him when he realizes his own theory of ideas might be at stake,
And so what he decides is, no, it's not an idea of nothing. It's the collectedness of the properties, all of which I do perceive. But I take them to belong together. But I never actually witness their togetherness at once. I think they go together. They always, you know, the color of this pen and its shape always seem to be coincident. But I don't actually perceive their coincidence literally. If there isn't a separate sensation that corresponds to the relationship between the color and the shape, is there? Color is color without having to be spread over space. But every colorful thing is spread over space. And it's being spread over space is a property of its shape. So this puzzle he solves by simply pointing to our tendency to gather together simple ideas of sensation that seem to come together in through individual perceptions. And it's their togetherness in perception that leads us to think that they're collected. And that the idea of that collectedness is what the concept of a substrate really comes to. And the problem is that it's not something that we actually witness directly. There isn't any simple idea of sensation that corresponds to the collectedness. It's rather the things that we do have ideas of, simple ideas of sensation, seem to be sort of together. But he doesn't really have an account of how that exactly works. It appears to be something that just is a psychological feature of the way we experience properties. Simple ideas of sensation always come with others. In particular, right, rich sense perceptual content. So, are we clear why we can't have the idea of a substrate that would play the role that Aristotle's matter played in fixing the identity of a material object? Sierra, you think I've done it? This is not easy. What about you, Matt? He's not so sure.
That sounds like a good reason we can't do that. I have a kind of different question. If every idea of a sensation is the idea of a property, are simple sense ideas the ideas of properties?
Well, simple ideas of sensation only become ideas of properties when they're made into concepts.
Okay.
But they start out, so they're always individual. Remember I said this is very important. Simple ideas precede any other kind of non-simple idea. Complex and general ideas on the chart that you can find in my notes. This has been up here before. General and complex ideas are generated through processing, mental processing on simple ideas of sensation or reflection or both.
Okay?
Yeah. Okay, so if you're clear about this, I hope then we can now circle back to the story about Ship of Theseus. The Ship of Theseus, in Locke's account of its identity, is going to be maintained differently. It's not going to depend on an appeal to both form and matter. It's going to be focused entirely on form and is going to exploit a fortunate fact about material things. They can't occupy the same space at the same time. Lucky for us. So we can now establish on independent, different on different grounds, why the Ship of Theseus no longer exists. Because when the Bohrs went over here to build the new ship, and new Bohrs were brought in to start this other new ship, we just now have two new ships. And the parts of the one are continuous, but have a different macro set of macro properties. So on Locke's account, that's no longer the Ship of Theseus, because it doesn't look like the ship. It doesn't have the visible macro properties, right? Sails differently, etc. But we're able, and the same thing is true of the ship made from the new boards on the old design. That has the design in common, but it doesn't have, right, it doesn't have the space-time worm for that ship begins the day that they assemble it. right? If we've got one ship that didn't even exist before this time, T4, then at T3, T2, T1, if that was the ship of Theseus, then this can't be. Right? So neither ship is the ship of Theseus on Locke's account. And he can establish that independent of anything that isn't available to us through perception. So this is his account of the identity of material things. And I've sort of given you the rough view of... it would be similar, by the way, for human beings. So it would turn out... since you made the very, you know, you were about to raise some important questions about living things and how, in many ways, I don't have the same words, to stretch a metaphor. But that doesn't matter, because this body, which used to be taller, and then shorter, and shorter, and shorter, and shorter, and smaller, right, and have more hair, and all the other stuff that happens, has been in the same location. So just pick a spot in the middle of my body and trace that back over, all the way back to 7:57 Central Time at the Rantoul Air Force Base in Illinois when I was born on February 1st, 1950. And that space-time chart uniquely identifies me as a human being. And then we don't have to deal with any of these complicated things about the function of my heart and all the functional parts that Aristotle had to appeal to. So the problem of identity for material objects, which was in doubt when we lost access to matter as the unique making part of any individual material object, has now been solved in a way that's consistent with empiricism about the source of ideas we can legitimately use to think about and describe the world around us. And of course, we need to be able to keep track of which objects are the same over time. It's one of the projects of science to explain change, and it's the job of a metaphysician to make sense of change in a way that doesn't require us to think that the world is changing in every respect all the time. Because if it is, it's not a world that we can do a science on. Right? However, there's a new problem, or a related problem, which Locke's critique of the concept of a substrate produces. And it's a problem about how we identify, how we establish the identity of a person over time. What makes me the same person over time? And here, it's extremely important for you to know, and if you've read the text, you do know, that Locke distinguishes between human beings and persons. And the fact that we all use the word person and human being more or less the same way, pointing to the same sorts of entities, Locke doesn't. In fact, if you've read the text, he talks about a thought experimental situation in which the person associated with the body of a cobbler enters the body of a prince, and the thing that constitutes the person and the prince moves into the body of the cobbler. And in that context, he asks the question, which is the prince and which is the cobbler? Where the question is not meant to be taken to couldn't be answered by telling us which human being is the prince and which human being is the cobbler. Their bodies haven't changed, and that's what makes you this human being rather than that human being. That's a distinction among bodies. But a person is not a body. A person is a mind. It's essentially that set of mental phenomena associated with, we usually think, with our bodies. And it's the identity of that that Locke wants to give an account of, because it used to be that persons, and from now on I'm just going to refer to this as the minds of human beings, because that's what he means. It's that set of mental phenomena, the associated faculties, and the content of conscious awareness, memory, etc., etc. So the combination of mental powers and mental content constitutes the person. And the account traditionally, since Aristotle, of the identity of a person, a mind, was fixed by a unique making immaterial substrate called the soul. And the soul is what made you the unique person, made your mind unique, combined with what your particular thoughts and your particular faculties. But here's the thing. We don't have access to perception of a soul conceived in this way, the way Aristotle did, because it too is a propertyless substrate. What are the properties that we don't perceive in it? We perceive all of the mental content, and we even perceive the actions of the faculties. So we actually have simple ideas of reflection that correspond to our concept of a mind. What we don't have are ideas of anything but those properties, but the substrate, the soul, the thing that binds all of these particular faculties in my mind and these ideas and mental content in my mind, all of my memories and so on, together, is not present in perception. So what holds them together? What plays the role of the substrate, which I don't perceive? I can't appeal to that anymore. I don't have access, perceptual access, to my soul. Yeah?
So the question is, what does the mind consist in?
The mind consists of a set of faculties.
Consist in.
What does it consist in?
Yeah.
You mean, what does it reside in?
That's his question.
Yeah, yes, exactly. I mean, what he's asking is, what makes the mind, he knows what the mind consists in the sense that he knows what makes my mind the sort of thing it is. It's having, you know, a set of faculties, reason, intellect, memory, you know, consciousness, perceptual consciousness, blah, 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 blah. But what makes me identical over time cannot be established by appeal to a soul, an immaterial substrate, that binds all of these faculties and all of my mental content together and makes them mine, because I don't perceive that. So then the question is, what can be restricted to just what we, those ideas we legitimately have about our minds? And those are all the ideas that are derived from simple ideas of reflection. Because that's what an idea of reflection is, remember? It's that impression left on the mind by an activity of the mind. An act of remembering includes what I remember, but it also has something else. Otherwise, I wouldn't detect that I'm remembering something rather than, let's say I'm remembering my grandmother's face, seeing my grandmother walking up to me. And that I can tell is a memory, not just because my grandmother's dead, but because I can tell when I'm remembering. How do I tell that? Well, there must be something about the activity of my memory which affects my consciousness in a way that makes me aware that that's happening. How do you know you're anxious? The answer to that is you have access to simple ideas of reflection. In this case, for Locke, all ideas of emotion, all emotions are essentially reflections. They're part of the category of ideas of reflection. And all mental content is idea. Remember, an idea is that which is before the mind when it thinks. And in thinking includes everything the mind does. So everything that's before you, everything that you're attending to all the time, is, you know, consists in ideas. This is a fact about Locke's view that eventually will lead to Berkeley, but we won't get to that for a while. Okay, so is this clear enough so far? Because I want to tell you now how Locke solves this problem, because at the moment, he doesn't have any way to establish which person is the prince and which person is the cobbler. He can't use the bodies, right? And he can't appeal to the soul of the prince or the soul of the cobbler to identify them by that route, because that is no longer available to him. because of his critique of the concept of a substrate, of a substance, without any properties of its own, just taking in all the properties and holding them together so that they are this unique thing with these essential properties. So what he does, he has to rely only on something that is present to perception, present to conscious awareness. And since it's the idea, a person is an idea of an immaterial entity, can't appeal to the brain. I know that's disappointing to those of you who hold to a to that strong thesis about mind-brain identity, but Locke has no access to that. In fact, well, I'll hold this for later. In an interesting way, he would be willing to consider mind-brain identity, but you can't establish that except by way of science, and I'll tell you why. And meanwhile, we have to have a way of deciding which person is the one whose brain is the source of their existence as a person, as a mind. So his solution, when you think about it, what is it that we're immediately aware of in a continuing way that we have a record of, which consists only of ideas of reflection? And which we could point to and say, well, those are the ideas which taken together comprise evidence that I have a mind. And if I can establish what those, so if I have these ideas, all I need now is, and I, we do have ideas of reflection, correct? We have lots of them. What is it about them that makes them unique? Because that's what we want. Something that, you know, Kaylee has in her case as a person that I don't have in my case as a person. Every one of you is a person. Every one of you has a collection of ideas of reflection. And those and that collection must have some, if this solution is going to work, there must be something unique about yours that makes it different from mine. And here's a problem. You might think, well, I'm uniquely me, and my experience is uniquely mine, so that makes it mine. Well, remember that we're all human beings, we're all minds of the same kind, according to Locke's theory. And you have all the same faculties that I have. Intellect, perception, sight, you know, hearing, touch, taste. If in fact you lack one of these faculties, I'm sorry, you know, I didn't know. But most of us have these the same five senses that produce the same array of sense ideas, and we have the same faculties of mind that are non-sensory. We have emotions of various kinds. We have right. We have memory. We have will. We have the ability to reason, to compare ideas, and so on and so on. All of us have these things. For this reason, if you assume that all our ideas of reflection are effects on the mind of its own activities, unless my mind is different in the faculties it has than yours, then the possible ideas of reflection my mind can generate is really not in principle different from the set of ideas that your mind can generate. But there is something, fortunately, that is connected with memory. Despite the fact that your stream of consciousness is built up out of exactly the same kinds of ideas as mine, ideas of reflection. You might want to challenge that, but I'm just telling you, Locke doesn't think so. And if there were fundamental differences in the quality of the emotions, for example, that I experience versus you, how would we know? Because I'm the only one who has direct access to mine, and you're the only one, each of you, who has direct access to yours, right? And for that reason, even if there were some qualitative difference that would make me unique and different from you, that would not be something we could use to make the distinction in a court of law. Which is, by the way, one of the reasons we want to know which person is which. And what if one of you has a dual personality? then the fact that the same body was involved doesn't show that the same person was involved. Okay. So, we don't have time to suspend this answer any further, so, but does anybody have, from your own reading, an idea of a strategy that turns on memory that might help us to establish what is unique about my stream of consciousness as compared to Matt's or Sierra's? Yeah.
Well, I can do it even though it's like the same fundamental things that happen like in unconsciousnesses. I think that every person like unique sensory experience is gonna like kind of like, because if it really is like a blank slate, like that you like go into the world with, like,
yes.
Every person's experience is going to be, like, so different that, like, the content of your mind is going to be very different.
So what is the source of the difference?
I think it's the sensory experience that everyone has. And also, I think that...
Okay, hold... Good. Just stay right there for a second and work with me. This is excellent. You have five senses, I have five senses. I assume your five are the same five I have. You're not suggesting that that when you look at that red coat of yours, you see something different than I see. Really?
I mean, maybe.
All right. Either it's different or it isn't. Let's suppose that it's different. How can we know that?
Kind of
can't. We more than kind of can't. We can't can. We fully and completely and permanently can. So while that might be, that would be great, if we could show that even the qualitative content of sense perception were different between persons, since that is, I mean, I've suggested that the core ideas about what constitutes the mind are generally built up from ideas of reflection, but ideas of sensation, insofar as they're mine, are very much a part of my unique sensorium, my unique stream of consciousness, and could be equally appealed to as part of what I think of as my mind. Because the power of sense perception is one of my main ones, right? And maybe the most obvious one. So let's include them. But if we can't show that the quality, to use a $10 word from contemporary philosophy, when you look at the color quality of that code, and I look at it, if we can't show that they're different, then that's not going to do Locke any good. It won't help him with this problem. So let's leave aside the possibility that the qualities are different. Let's assume they're exactly the same when we are influenced by the same objects under the same perceptual conditions. And that when you feel anxious, right, In principle, it there's no reason to think it would be any different, although the conditions that make you anxious might be different. Sadness is sadness, right? Maybe there are degrees of sadness, but sadness is clearly, so let's assume that all the qualitative differences that might exist for any particular qualia, both a reflection or sensation, are identical for any person, any mind. What can we use to nonetheless show that when you perceive that coat, it's you, and when I perceive it, it's me? And Locke has a way to do that. That assumes that what we see is the same, but yours is yours and mine is mine, but we can't use our different locations, because that would help, right? Since when you look at it, you're in one place on Earth, and when I look at it, I'm in another place on Earth. We can't be in the same place at the same time, right? And be looking at that same thing in the same, from the same angle, in the exact same lighting, and so on. So, for that reason, if I could appeal to my body, I could probably build up an account of my identity and yours. But that would be to depend on the body, and we don't have access to that. Locke's answer is is sort of staring us in the face. Your memory of the sequence of your experiences, going all the way back to your earliest memories, is a sequence that's recorded in a certain order.
And while in principle you could have experienced everything I've ever experienced, the actual record of your stream of consciousness is different. And if we had a perfect record of that stream of consciousness, you know, like the memory is sort of like a surveillance system that is recording everything that goes across the mental transom, then wouldn't that make me unique? Mine would be substantially different from any of yours, right? Even with respect to sensory information, because what I would see at a given moment would be different from what you see at a given moment. And this would be true even of identical twins who were born simultaneously, if that's possible. Well, it is possible if they're born by cesarean, right? You just pick them up together, hold them close, let them look at the room together, you know, side by side. But their touch sensations are going to be different. They're going to see the room slightly from a different angle. So even under those, you might say, ideal conditions for having the same light, the same stream of perceptions, they would be different. So Locke's answer to the problem of personal identity is our ability to extend our consciousness over a set S of memories. And as our experience continues, the set expands, adding to what was built into the memory up to the point, right, when we started having new experiences. And this is what constitutes personal identity, PID. So the idea is, I can establish that I'm the same person as I was when I was 18, if I can remember all the same things, all the things that I remembered about my life when I was 18. Or, let's say, enough of them. Major events. The several times I broke bones. The time I broke this forearm taking a swing at my brother because he wouldn't be quiet so I could go to sleep. These are part of the consequences of sharing bedrooms, at least between boys who fight all the time. So Locke thinks that we can tell the difference now between the cobbler and the prince because the cobbler, though now living in the palace, remembers making shoes, and the prince has no such memory, although apparently he's going to have to start figuring out how to do that. And this relies only on things which are available according to the empiricist theory of ideas, available to the human mind under ordinary circumstances, that on the basis of which you can establish something unique about your stream of consciousness because of the way it's recorded in memory. And one of the features is that it's recorded sort of in order. If we had memory that wasn't like that, this might not be as helpful as it is. So next time, because we're basically done, next time we're going to... So, two things. I would hope that you would come next time having looked over the study guide with some questions that I'm happy to try to answer in the time we'll have them. The first 10 minutes I'm going to spend talking about some problems with Locke's solution to the problem of personal identity. And we'll talk about that, but only for about 10 minutes. Then I'll take questions. However, also, during my office hour from 11 to 11:50 on Friday, as well as the entire afternoon until 6 in my office from 2 o'clock, I'll be in my office, and there, if anyone wants to wander in and ask questions that they have about the study guide, so that on Monday when we have
the final, the midterm exam, you'll be better prepared. And I'll be looking for questions coming to me by email as well. So I'm assuming that these two sources, along with the online sources, I'm about to upload recordings of these recent lectures.